for argument this morning is Ruffin Tompkins against Experian.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, Section 1681I, has provisions requiring when a consumer has a dispute regarding their credit report and conveys that to the agency, and in this case Experian, that the Experian undertake an investigation of that dispute. And while part of that investigation requires that they forward this dispute on to the company that furnished the information, part of it also requires that they themselves independently consider the dispute from the consumer. Whether this investigation is reasonable and whether they've done their duty under the Act is a question of fact in overwhelming number of in just about every case. It's a rare instance where reasonableness is beyond question. In this case, the trial court below spoke rather generally by saying that the investigation procedure that Experian has set up is reasonable in and of itself, and for that reason granted summary judgment. This is something that's to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, and the question is whether in this circumstance, given Ms. Ruffin Tompkins' disputes, whether or not they were reasonable towards her.
Did you argue in the district court about the appropriateness of Experian's response to the first inquiry, the one that didn't mention the bank?
Our Rule 56 statement of facts spelled it out. We discussed how our client
statements
did.
Statements of facts don't argue anything. My question is, did you argue this in the district court?
In scouring through my district court response, I didn't see any specific part where we said to the judge that, referring back to our statement of facts, that this particular dispute right here was problematic. We did.
But isn't that the main problem here? All your damages are from the period between the first request, the one that didn't mention the bank, and the second request, which did. But the only theory of unreasonable behavior by Experian that seems to have been argued in the district court concerns the second request.
Again,
you have a mismatch between the theory of liability and the period in which damages are available.
Well, first of all, the third of the disputes, which was the one that we really spent a lot of time arguing, does correlate with our client's damages. The recent decision by this court in Wants discussed that once the district court receives any notification of a dispute and then the credit report is sometime thereafter accessed and this inaccuracy appears on there, that could give rise to damages, especially in an emotional distress context. Where, and I'm sure one of the arguments you'll hear from Experian is that given this circuit's high threshold for emotional distress, one must show that it's inherently degrading or humiliating. That, too, whether or not a repossession being on your credit report, given the fact that you only have four items on your credit report, whether or not that's inherently humiliating is a question of fact, and that was something that had been on there, and we alleged and we showed it was on there until 6 months after our client disputed this to Experian, even if you were to consider the December dispute only. But we did bring to light the fact that there was a dispute, and any claim that Experian didn't have notification of my client's dispute in October is just not true. They absolutely did. And in that particular dispute, given the fact that there were just four trade lines and only one was an auto loan and only one said repossession on it, chose to read her dispute and not consider it being a dispute about a repossession, just chose for it to be a dispute about a car dealership. And I argue to this panel that too was a violation of 1681I. They also claim that they didn't get my client's second dispute. The fact of the matter is, what we showed was she sent in three disputes, all three the same exact way to the same address, two were received, one could infer that the third one was received, and Experian just chose not to do anything about it because of the way it was written. On that third dispute, the one that we did spend a great deal of time arguing in front of the district court, was they clearly an issue of whether or not they were negligent in that one. In that one, she also disputed that she did not have any repossession. And their dispute process was to create a document called a CDV. That Judge Leinenweber felt was not in and of itself unreasonable, and we're not arguing that their dispute process is unreasonable in and of itself. But in this circumstance, given the fact that they have to consider her dispute and forward all relevant information to the furnisher, all they did was prepare a document that gave the account and said claims company will change or delete, and that was not conveying accurate information regarding or relevant information regarding the dispute. The Cushman case, which we cited, even said that a jury could find that the credit reporting agency should have known that its source itself was unreliable because they made it unreliable. And that's an argument that Experian
did they makes. Have a category that would fit your circumstance better than the one that they used?
A category meaning one of the right. a code that they can put on the CDV?
Right.
I don't know if they do, but if they don't, well, then whose problem is that? It should be their problem. If they're going to convey relevant information, well, the fact that they don't have a code, if they don't have a code that matches it, is their problem. Because then they're setting themselves up across the board to be unable to provide a furnishing company a dispute about a repossession. And I'm sure it's not the first time that somebody's disputed that they never had a repossession. And I'm sure it's not the first time a repossession's been reported to Experian by an auto lender. One of the arguments that we hear from Experian is that we failed to show that the source that gave them the information was unreliable. And one of the things that Cushman said was, actually, a jury can find them unreliable if you're not making them reliable, if you're not conveying to them the information they need to conduct an investigation, then you should know, Experian, that they're not reliable because they don't have everything. They don't have all the tools you have and all the information you have. And that's exactly what happened in this case, just like Cushman. They did not make them reliable because they did not convey the full dispute. And finally, with respect to damages, we did show that my client's credit report was, in fact, accessed. It wasn't accessed by a current creditor. It was accessed by someone she did not have credit with. The only permissible reason would be to determine whether or not they would grant her credit, and they didn't. And it happened after Experian received some knowledge. Whether or not that's humiliating or degrading, even by this circuit standards, which are tougher than most we've seen, is still a question of fact. Because whether or not somebody would be humiliated by somebody seeing a repossession on their credit report, especially in light of the fact that it is without question untrue, is a question of fact for the jury. So that we ask that the district court be reversed. If there's no further questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Smith.
You.
Mr. Bromberg.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I think it's crucial to understand what exactly is in the record and what is not, because I believe that when you see what is in the record, you will find that Judge Leinenweber's decision was correct and should be affirmed. Now, with respect to the third letter, the letter that I think was sent on December 10th of 2002, Mr. Smith has suggested, perhaps inadvertently, that there was a reference in that letter and the accompanying documents to a repossession. There wasn't. There's no reference to a repossession or to any of the previous communications. Now, what Experian did when it received these letters was it promptly reviewed them, and it looked to see what the basis of the dispute was. Now, the letter on its face doesn't say very much. It just says, I am disputing the U.S. Bank's report to your credit bureau. But if you look at one of the accompanying letters, which Experian did, what you see is that as part of the settlement with the Grosvenor City Toyota, the plaintiff was promised that the auto dealership would notify the bank, and I'm quoting from this July 8, 2002 letter, would notify the bank that there should be no further adverse report on your credit history. So what Experian did was it sent a consumer dispute verification form to U.S. Bank, and it said on there that the basis of the dispute was that the plaintiff claims the company will change or delete.
But it didn't say why, right? This reads like something from some functionary to another functionary just to shuffle papers, but it can't be serious. How is the functionary at the bank who gets this in some receiving department going to know why?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important to realize the volume of requests that are...
Exactly the reason why you need to say why in the form. Because there's a huge volume of requests at the other end, too, and they don't have a clue if you don't say why.
Well, Your Honor, I think in this case that may, of course, not be true because the plaintiff had submitted a letter on October 20th which specifically referenced the repossession.
If indeed
but even
the bank
more
does further research, unprovoked by Experian, searches its complete records, it may find further documentation. But a copy or pointing to it, right? Looking at this reminds me of nothing so much as calling up on the phone and getting one of these automated systems on the end that says, push number one if you wish to speak to a chihuahua now, right? Push number two if you really want a cheeseburger, right? And then after about five or six of these have been done and there's no choice that's even remotely related to what you really want, I mean, what do you do? And that's what this looks like.
Well, Your Honor, I'm at a bit of a disadvantage here because the plaintiff did not raise the issue of repossession in their briefs down below. If you look at pages 6 through 9 of their memorandum in opposition to summary judgment, they didn't raise this issue. As a consequence, we did not have a chance to develop the evidence in the record that would explain what exactly we did and why it was reasonable. And this is a classic case where the argument should be waived because the other side did not have a chance to respond to the factual issue that was raised.
I don't understand they didn't raise it. Weren't there two entries in the initial report that was a problem? Not two entries, but there were a slash between it, repossession and something else. What was the other?
Yes.
The amount due?
That's correct.
Doesn't that raise it?
Well, you can't assume that every single thing that is on a
wait a minute.
Report.
There are two items divided by a slash.
Well, Your Honor,
and you got one of them deleted, and they left a repossession.
But the fact is that the letter that we received on December 10th, the only reference to any problem with the U.S. Bank report had to deal with the
issue that
I quoted.
And that's because you don't have a category among your 8 or 10 categories that covers repossession, right? To delete it?
Your Honor, to tell you the truth, I don't know, because this is an issue which was not raised below.
Now,
if you look at Judge Leinenweber's decision, he's very clear in saying
I don't understand why it wasn't raised if it's part and parcel of the problem on the credit report.
Well, Your Honor, the argument that the plaintiff made down below, and you'll see it on pages 6 through 9 of their memorandum, was a very sweeping argument. They were trying to establish the principle that every time there is a request for reinvestigation, there has to be an independent reinvestigation beyond contacting the source by the credit reporting agency.
Look, to the extent they're saying that every time they get one of these letters, they have to go out and hire Griffin Bell, and he will bring in a team from King and Spaulding to do an independent inquiry, they're obviously not going to win. But to the extent they're making the point that the response has to have something to do with the inquiry, so that the response, item not found, colon, Grosvenor City, Toyota, which is what you might get out of a computer database where no human being had ever given the matter 15 seconds thought, to the extent that remains Experian's method of responding to these, you may win this case on a litigation quirk. But you've got yourself a serious problem.
Your Honor, I understand that, and I will speak to my client about that. But I do think it's important to understand that because of the volume of requests that go through, the information is conveyed in a shorthand. And we would have attempted down below to show that this would, in fact, have been understood properly by the source. Now, with respect to the damages issues, It's also important to look and see what exactly is in the record in this case. Now, with respect to emotional distress, which was discussed, the damages were discussed, the actual damages on pages, I think, 9 and 10 of the memorandum below, there was no evidence that was cited. Now, before the Court of Appeals, the plaintiff has cited an interrogatory answer, but that interrogatory answer was not submitted by them. It was actually submitted by us to show that there were no evidence supporting another damage theory, which is not being advanced on appeal. And there was no reference to it in the district court. As a consequence, the district court had no evidence of emotional distress before it. Now, with respect to the credit denials, this gets a little bit more complicated. And respectfully, Judge Easterbrook, I would suggest that you may not have understood the entire record here. Because the fact of the matter is that there is not a request for a credit report between October and December of 2002. Plaintiff has referred to a number of supposed credit requests. Two of them don't appear on the credit reports that they cite. That's from Providian Financial and Amcor. There are three that appear under the category requests viewed by others, and I'm looking at page 6 of the April 2nd, 2003 report, which is Exhibit K to the plaintiff's exhibits appendix down below. And there you have a reference to CarMax, which indicates that the date of the request was on September 28th, 2002. There is also a reference to requests by the CoreTrust Bank, the latest of which was in May of 2002, and First National Credit, which was in April of 2002. Now, obviously, Experian's failure to conduct a reasonable reinvestigation, if there was any, could not have caused those denials because the investigation occurred months afterwards. Now, the only supposed credit denial that occurred after the reinvestigations began is the Premier Bank Card. That's on page 6 of this credit report. There was supposedly a request, which occurred in January of 2003. But this is a very interesting entry. This doesn't appear with the other entries, which are under the category requests viewed by others. Now, that category is described as indicating creditors who have requested in the recent past to review your credit history as a result of actions involving you, such as the completion of a credit application. The Premier Bank Card entry appears in a different category, requests reviewed only by you, which covers a variety of different things such as pre-approved credit. The inference is clear that there was no completed credit application for Premier Bank. And as Judge Leinenweber pointed out, plaintiff has not submitted any application or any letter of denial from Premier Bank Card. Furthermore, we issued a subpoena to them asking for any such documents, and it came back from the custodian of records from Premier Bank Card saying, we have no record of any application. So what we have is no evidence of any...
This pre-approved, is that the sort of mass mailing sent out, you're pre-approved for so-and-so?
That's absolutely it, Your Honor. And my understanding of that process is that the credit card companies will say, we want to send applications to everybody who is in a certain geographic area who meets these criteria. And the credit reporting agency provides them with those names and addresses. Doesn't provide them with a credit report. That stuff is all done later when there's an actual application. So the key point here is that there is no evidence of any application that was denied as a result of the supposed failure to investigate here. Now, we would also submit that there is no evidence that there was any willful violation here for the simple reason that it's a very difficult standard to meet. Generally, you have to have a conscious misrepresentation, actual concealment, or something of that level. Now, plaintiff contends that there is some sort of systematic error that's involved here, but a good faith error does not constitute willfulness. And as we have indicated in our brief, there are numerous lower court cases which have approved the basic procedure that we use, and we think that is enough to defeat any claim for willfulness in this case. If Your Honors don't have any more questions, I'd like to urge the court again to affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gromberg. Anything further, Mr. Smith?
Briefly, Your Honors. Thank you.
The first thing Experian should have done when they got any dispute from my client is look at what they are reporting. And you seem to bring it up in your questioning of counsel. To know what the dispute is and to pass it along correctly, first look at what it is you're reporting. That might even help give the investigator an idea as to what it is they should be looking for. And if they would have looked at what they were reporting, they would have seen very clearly that they were reporting a repossession, which is, without a doubt, a derogatory remark against my client. And that was something that she was trying to get corrected. There's some criticism of how my client disputed, and I hope that the court takes into consideration that an average person probably doesn't know how this, and I'll call it a machine, how this machine thinks, because that's apparently how it operates. Counsel commented on the overwhelming volume. Well, yes, there is, but that's their business. Their business is to collect a volume of information, and it tends to have inaccuracies, and they have to come up with a way to handle it. And the way they handled this one was inadequate. Ruff and Tompkins does not know what Experian is thinking when they get something, but she does know that her credit report's wrong, and they have the obligation to look at it. And we're not asking for some kind of independent inquiry where an outside firm is hired. That's not necessary. But it doesn't end with just accessing a trade line on a report and forwarding it out to the company and waiting for the response to come back. And whatever the response is acceptable and what my client's report is going to look like in the future. They need to do something on their own, and I suggest in this case, at the very least, they could have read and looked at what they were doing on their own. Furthermore, we saw that they knew there was a mother party involved, a Grossinger City Toyota. They knew somebody else was there. There was somebody else to contact, perhaps to help with this investigation. It would have gotten this trade line removed from my client's credit report swiftly and accurately. With respect to my client's damages, counsel pointed out some of the other credit reports that showed inquiries, and there were opportunities lost. There were promotional opportunities that were lost, and also there was companies that looked at her credit report. If you look at the record, even in January 2003, MBNA looked at her credit report to see what was on there. And Ms. Ruff and Tompkins, knowing full well that one of the things that this company or any company that looked was going to see, was they were going to see that of the few items of credit she has, one of them was a repossession, and that it apparently looked like some tow truck came out to her house, picked up a car, hooked it up, and drove it away. And that's not what happened. The credit report was inaccurate. It didn't come off for several months, and it caused her harm. If there's no further questions, I've completed, and thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. The case is taken under advisement.